Welcome to the Save the Earth podcast, bringing together UConn activists and experts to discuss different ways of thinking about the climate crisis and looking for next steps. This podcast was put together by UConn Perug's Save the Earth campaign, and this is episode 4, Preventing versus Adapting to the Climate Crisis. I'm your host, Ben Albee. Today, we'll be talking about global linkages of climate change and the difference between preventing climate change in the long term and supporting those who are already affected and at risk. Unfortunately, Monet is sick today and can't help me moderate. Don't worry, she doesn't have COVID. That said, I'm very excited to introduce our guests, UConn Perug Social Chair Chad Schroeder and UConn Environmental Studies Director, International Studies Association Executive Director, and Board of Trustees Distinguished Professor Mark Boyer. How are you guys doing today?
Very good. Thank you for inviting me here.
Of course.
Doing well. Thank you.
Cool. I'm going to get into the questions, and I'm so glad that you guys are able to be here. So this first one goes to both of you. Just feel free to respond how you will. Focusing on UConn and like Collins County, how does living in this area compared to living in Hartford, Bridgeport, and New Haven in terms of climate vulnerability?
Yeah, there are a lot of dimensions here that you can focus on, and there's no definitive answer, I guess, is the simple way to do it. You know, when you're dealing with climate vulnerability in an urban environment, you're dealing with a lot of paved surfaces, a lot of potential water runoff, potential flash flooding and other kinds of things. But then when you're in the country like we are in Storrs or in Mansfield or much of Collin County, you know, you're dealing with other factors that are involved in all of this. So again, if you're water proximate, whether you're close to a stream or a river, you could have flooding issues. But you have much more absorption of water when, you know, you have a rain bomb or you have some kind of crazy weather. But, you know, the other part to all of this, and this is both in terms of sort of thinking about climate mitigation and the needs for adaptation, is that the density of cities is actually in general a positive thing for climate management, because you're not driving as much. I mean, when we live in Storrs, I have to drive everywhere. I mean, there's very little you can do. I can't even really bike to campus unless I want to shower the second I get there. So there are a lot of variables involved in all this kind of stuff.
Right. Chad, do you have anything to add to that?
Nothing major. The way I kind of interpreted this question was more on the side of looking at like the kind of vulnerabilities that are more involved in cities due to the populations that are kind of concentrated there. Mm-hmm. You're like low income, concentration of environmental pollution, like the associated health impacts, especially if they're like along the shoreline. Sometimes there's a lot of low income people based there. So kind of thinking about those vulnerabilities kind of comparing to rural made me kind of think about how people are really going to have to be planning in a very concerted effort in the long term to address how those populations are still going to be able to have their basic necessities met when these big events really come to fruition, combined with all these other impacts that Mark Boyer, you just mentioned in the urban environment, such as the urban heat island effect and all the issues with stormwater.
Mm-hmm. And so we kind of see a distinction between the effect that urban versus rural areas have on the climate crisis and how safe each of them are. But kind of in that same sense, for a long time, there's been this rhetoric about climate change as like preventing it. But, you know, with Hurricane Maria, droughts, wildfires, and even sea level rise here in Connecticut, it seems that climate change is already happening. So why is it important to adapt to it and keep ourselves safe, as well as mitigating it? And what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, I mean, we adapt to climate change because we have to. Right. I mean, in an everyday kind of way, we're all encountering different kinds of vulnerabilities and different kind of impacts than we felt, you know, when I was a child in the 1960s and 1970s. And And so in many respects, whether it's things like sea level rise if you live on the coast, or if you're in agriculture, the impact that climate change is having on crop production, or even dairy production, because dairy cattle are very sensitive to small changes in temperature in their barns and dairy facilities. So there are a lot of different ways that we need to adjust, and in many respects, it's forced on us. And I think that's in many respects going to be the driver of change, more so than us selling to the average person, you know, you need to cut back on your carbon emissions. It's more about, look, you've got this stuff in front of you. You need to take care of it. You need to deal with it. You need to, you know, remember that you're going to have, you know, more stormwater running next to your house and eroding the edge of your driveway and so on and so forth. And, you know, in one of the interviews that I did a number of years ago for a research project, you get these little pithy quotes from some of the activists that I talked to. And the one was that adaptation is the backdoor to mitigation, that adaptation is the way that people begin to understand that climate change is real and it's something we need to grapple with. And I think that's increasingly happening as people are realizing that whether it's Maria or Superstorm Sandy or, you know, the October snowstorm and all of those, you know, famous weather events, people are starting to realize that, yeah, these are things we need to deal with. And now I know why they're caused.
Mm-hmm. And it's not so much an abstract concept anymore.
No, it's very demonstrative, you know, because greenhouse gas emissions are, you know, really the impact of what I emit today is really going to impact you guys 50 years out. So it's not something that's really impacting me today, except in a secondary kind of way.
So Chad, I'll let you answer that too, but kind of going off of that, would you say that, you know, if the adaptations that we, you know, to protect oneself from the climate crisis, can that just have an adverse effect and like further climate change, and then by protecting ourselves from it, we're making it worse for future generations? Is that possible?
Sure. I mean, I think there are issues that you have to worry about what we're doing. And I mean, a very, very specific one is it's an example that's oftentimes trotted out when you're talking about climate adaptation, are seawalls. You know, lots of coastal communities are building seawalls. And obviously in the short term, seawalls do a great job of keeping out, keeping the water away from a property. Okay. But the problem is that they actually lead to further beach erosion wherever they are, because the water hits the wall, drives downward, and then washes more stuff out. And so in the long run, it's actually making the coastal erosion and coastal problems worse, even if in the short run, you know, whatever the short run is, 10, 20 years, they're helping. And so, yes, some adaptation features are going to create problems that are just bigger down the road. Yeah, unfortunately.
I guess from my perspective, I kind of look at it as you got to do them both kind of hand in hand. especially though, I think the point Dr. Roy just mentioned about the seawalls is super important, because I read a few like development proposals for a project I was working on last semester on brownfields. And there's a whole bunch of redevelopment going on right along the shoreline, which when I was looking at the floodplain maps, which surprisingly need to still be updated for the current projections for sea level rise, a lot of these sites are within the floodplains. And some of the development proposals were talking about a 1% chance, which is a 100-year flood event, as a minor thing for them to be worried about, even though that is like the exact chance of their site being flooded in 100 years, which is something they should be concerned about. But their development proposal had no real concern for it. So it really starts raising the question, are we concerned more about ensuring long-term property values, or really trying to adapt to the climate crisis and what we're really being told by the environment, which is what we should be listening to. And that's what the science is kind of telling us. And I sometimes worry policymakers have strayed away from really following that, instead of really taking to what the science is showing. Instead of building seawalls, we should be looking at living shorelines and ways to really use ecological habitats to really boost up the environment and protect ourselves.
Yeah. And kind of like how you said, right, earlier, how they go hand in hand. It's not one or the other. Boy, did you have something to say?
Yeah, no, and I think that, you know, that those are really good points, Chad. And I think as you focus on a lot of these issues with regards to shoreline development, you know, a lot of it comes down to money, that you have wealth, tend to have wealthier people living at the shoreline than not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those who are going to have to relocate are going to fight it tooth and nail. And that's oftentimes a very controversial issue. But you also have, you know, a role for the insurance companies that are playing. At some point, the insurance companies are going to stop insuring homes on that are seriously vulnerable. And, you know, when you're getting hit right, left and center on the North Carolina coast or on the Jersey Shore or something like that, at some point, the insurance companies are just saying, no, we're not going to let you rebuild. Or if you rebuild, it's all your own dime. And I think that that's where things are going to come. Is when the insurance industry actually changes the way they do things.
So I think that's a really important point. And I can cut this out because I know this is like a can be a sensitive topic. But my question is, as UConn students, and, you know, the board is mostly insurance CEOs, do we have like some sort of special power in how they in how they're going to change?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I'm a representative on the Board of Trustees right now for the faculty. And so I've gotten to know a number of the board members pretty well. And I think overall, the people that are involved in the insurance industry are among the most progressive on climate change, because they're the ones who are worried about the financial impact.
Sure.
So I don't think they're averse to doing this kind of thing. I think at this point they're still in sort of risk management mode, but they're very concerned about it. And in fact, you know, some of the insurance companies have been the most progressive of the business interests in supporting climate change, progressive climate change policies. I think it's a lot of other places that aren't, like the energy industry, particularly the fossil fuel industry and others. But the insurance industry, you know, has this in their sights, because it's a monetary hit for them.
Yeah.
So
Okay, that's very interesting to me. I had no idea that insurance CEOs were progressive. I guess that's
In this context, anyway.
Of course. Chad, do you have anything to add to that?
Not particularly. No, I think that's a very interesting point.
Yeah. So I think I'm gonna harp on this a little bit more because I just find it interesting. So when you do say that the insurance industry needs to change, that doesn't come from well-minded executives in the insurance industry.
Well, it does, but it's all about in the end, it's about risk management, and so they may be getting more risk averse, but they're also financing things, from the standpoint of the premiums going up. And so if you want to have insurance for your home on Long Island Sound, you know, what might have been insured for flood insurance, and I'm just making up numbers here. Let's say your home was insured for $2,000 a year 10 years ago, it might be $3,000 or $4,000 a year now. Okay. And so they're dealing with the increased risk by charging the customer more. You still have that insurance, but it's much more costly than it was. And so I think that in the future, there's going to become a point where you're not going to be able to get flood insurance. There's another perfect example of this is related to the fires in California this past year. About a year ago, some of the insurance companies in the state of California decided that they were not going to provide fire insurance to homes in California that were in fire prone areas. And the California state legislature passed a law that said, no, you still have to provide fire insurance to homes. And so they had gotten to the point where they were doing it, and I don't know what the mix of premium increases are, but they were basically forced to continue providing the fire insurance in the state of California by the legislature. You know, so there's an interesting dynamic going on back and forth. And in some, well, at some level, that's a consumer protection issue.
Right.
That the legislature is saying, yes, you have to protect our families. And, you know, they're living in places that are fire prone, but you still need to provide them insurance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as that situation keeps getting more dangerous. It's just going to keep getting more and more difficult for everyone involved there.
Yeah, no, it's a huge issue. It's a huge issue. Yeah.
So it is a huge issue. It's a global issue. It's affecting every part of the world, or most parts of the world, I guess. But I know, Professor Boyer, you focus a lot on local global linkages. So generally, can you explain why it's important for us to think locally with this global problem?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, what climate change is in so many ways is the consummate global issue. And I'm, you know, fundamentally a global studies scholar is really where I come from, in my own research and writing and my background. But as I started to dig into climate change about 10 or 15 years ago, it became abundantly clear really quickly that most of the impacts are felt locally. And so whether this is increased pollution around the dense cities, whether it's increased flooding, agricultural impacts, the list goes on, that global issue is producing things that each of us in our own way has to deal with in our in managing our lifestyles. You know, even things like Zika, you know, we wouldn't have a mosquito-borne disease like Zika if it weren't for climate change. But clearly, you know, mosquito vector diseases are moving up out of the tropics and into places that they wouldn't have been 10, 15, 20 years ago because of climate change, and it's impacting us at a very local level. So I think that that's where the problem is global, but most of the action is going to happen at the local level to actually grapple with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Chad, I'm going to ask you, do you have anything to add?
I always think of it in a pretty similar way. People always, and from my perspective, know their local communities the best and know what local issues they're facing. So they're going to be the best to be able to find the tools and solutions to address those issues. And if we're able to empower these communities with the information and the scientific information to make informed decisions and the resources without constraining them to specific options that may be for profitable ends or something, we can really adapt to this issue in a meaningful way. And I think produce co-benefits, not just to like the community for adapting to climate change, but really building an actual community infrastructure where they're able to have these decisions made in a way that really uses information as well as dealing with their own issues that they may have within the community to collectively come to these ways that they're going to have to adapt if they want to retain that community they built.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm understanding this correctly, kind of the way I'm seeing it is, you know, if some community in, for example, I don't know, England is having some pollution problem, and it's affecting the whole community, in like one city in England, it's just an example. I'm not going to care that much because like it's not my community. It's not this huge problem, but it's still a problem that is seriously affecting that community. So they're the ones that's going to best address it.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's exactly correct. The community knows more about the particulars on the ground. The rub in all of that is that most communities don't have the resources to be able to deal with climate adaptation. And so whether it's in the UK or whether it's in the US, the local community relies on a state or a province or or the federal government to provide the monetary resources to be able to grapple with a particular situation. So, you know, that's the problem when, you know, in the U.S. context over the past 4 years, and certainly during most of the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, you know, what you saw was local communities trying to grapple with climate change, but not having the resources available because the federal government wasn't providing those kinds of resources. So it needs to be dealt with at the local level, as Chaz says, but it still needs the funding and the resourcing from higher governmental levels to actually pull it off.
Right. And it kind of seems like you were alluding to an example that I think a lot of our listeners will know about is Hurricane Katrina. And yeah, that happened during the Bush administration, and there was not really that much of a response to helping that community that was ravaged by this terrible hurricane that was made worse by climate change.
Yep. Yeah, no question about it. Katrina was a disaster in 2005, and yeah, you know, it could have been handled a lot better, just as, you know, Hurricane Harvey was, and all of the rest of these major storms, the preparations for them and the responses have been problematic at best for the most part. Yeah.
I think too, with storms like Hurricane Katrina and the problem that occurred in New Orleans and everything, we have to kind of look at like the development that occurred and how we've been treating the environment in that area for so long with the dredging of the rivers and everything, and really upsetting that natural balance that was established, that was preventing that area from being as heavily flooded as it was. And I think hopefully we're going to be turning a new leaf with the new administration that's coming in the way we are taking adaptation and mitigation solutions to climate change. But I think a lot of the research that's being done at UConn by professors, as well as some of the solutions you've offered, Dr. Boyer, are really showcasing that localized action meshing with like the more ecological, instead of these top-down approaches dictated by governance structures, are going to be the most effective solutions to really address these long-term inequalities and developmental issues we've had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, there's some really important points. And obviously a very important point about Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Harvey is that the people who are most affected and helped the least are often BIPOC communities, low-income communities.
Yeah.
So we really have to think about this intersectionally.
Yeah, no, you really do. And it's not just in the United States, but if you look at the coastal areas and some of the major cities around the world, you know, in the developing world, you're also seeing that the gigantic cities, Lagos, Nigeria, Accra, Ghana, and places like that, that are all in low-lying areas that will be severely affected by climate change over the next 25 to 50 years. And the capacity to adapt in those places is significantly lower even than the poorer cities in a place like the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, and also with in mind that was touched on a little bit earlier is the fact that, you know, a lot of the inhibitors to change is just the fact that communities don't have the adequate resources and monetary resources to respond to these disasters and climate issues. Mm-hmm. Though I would say a lot of people that I have talked to think that climate deniers are the main inhibitor to change and organizing around, you know, climate adaptation and mitigation. Would you say that it's climate deniers, or is it something else?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really tough question to answer. And, you know, at some level, this is where my cynicism comes in pretty strongly, that yes, climate deniers are a significant group within, say, the American electorate, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you look at some of the research that's come out of the Yale Six Americas study, and if you look at, you know, their polling of individuals and what their attitudes are on climate change, there's actually quite a significant majority in the American public who see climate change as a very serious threat. Mm-hmm. And so it's more that our elected leaders are out of sync with the public attitudes than it is that the climate deniers are preventing things from happening. Now, the climate deniers may be members of Congress, but I think it's also more that those individuals are being funded by fossil fuel interests and by other interests that are pushing for a version of economic development that is grounded in, you know, the you know, a model of economic development from the 19th and 20th centuries, rather than something that's looking ahead and looking at new opportunities for development, whether it's a green economy or whatever you want to call it. And I think that's more the issue, that the money is still driving our elected officials to make decisions that are myopic and ill-informed, than it is necessarily the climate deniers being the inhibitors of change per se.
Right. So with that in mind, with this organizing, what can students do individually? And, you know, because that's such a huge issue, money, like billions and billions of dollars are in the hands that we don't want them in to solve climate change. How can students change that?
Well, I think a lot of ways. I mean, it's great, the kinds of things you're doing with this podcast and lots of other initiatives is just to keep pushing. You know, we see what happens when grassroots action takes place. And eventually, and it may not happen tomorrow, it may not happen next week, but eventually the push to have progressive change and progressive policy change ultimately is effective. It just takes a long time. I mean, I'm thrilled that, you know, Donald Trump is leaving office, because he's, you know, just, you know, a completely incompetent moron and on so many levels. But I view, and I hope I'm correct, that his election and his administration was more the dying gasp before real change can happen than it is something that is, you know, a harbinger of something horrible that's going to come back at us in 4 or another 8 years or something like that. Now, again, I could be wrong, because clearly 70 million people voted for him, but you know, it's still hopefully it's the dying gasp.
I like that. I'm going to try to think about it that way as well from now on. Chad, what do you think?
But going back to the other question, I don't think it necessarily is climate deniers who are the biggest barrier. Public perception is dictated a lot by the media and by our politicians, who have not been active in any way, shape, or form on addressing these issues. Some have been in power for 40 years and haven't taken the issue seriously and are running for election again. That's besides the point. I think that goes to show that they have and that they have people that pay for their real salary and not their congressional one. And that's really for their reelection. And I think that also goes to the ideology that's really dominated climate inaction over the past few decades, which I would say is neoliberalism more than anything else. Yeah. The inability of a party in American politics to put any sort of agenda forward on climate change that doesn't include fracking or natural gas expansion, let alone actual representative climate justice reparations for the global South, considering the climate emissions that the US has contributed. I think it really goes to show that if we want to deal with the issue of climate change, the US has a lot more to grapple with than just the issue of climate change adaptation. There's really systemic issues at play that I think came out of the election of Donald Trump. I think personally, we're going to see resurge in a few more years, since his base has become pretty alienated and directionless. And I think they are a very radicalized bunch that can very easily be led into eco-fascism and have a view that we need to isolate ourselves out from the rest of the world. And that might be an American symptom, but I do worry that America will turn inward instead of looking outward to try to lead the world, just because of the dynamic that has emerged recently, how Americans are treating each other in such a polarized environment.
And I think that point you made about isolation is really important, because I feel like we can't just say, I think it's important for America to be a leader in you know, climate activism, but, you know, changing the way that we run things. But it can't just be like one American party. It has to be like, we have to reach out with the entire world while also staying local. So that's all my questions. Do you guys have any wrapping up thoughts, anything else that you guys have been thinking about?
No, I mean, you know, part of the thing that I struggle with, just in sort of in closing, is that I'm inherently an optimist on so many levels. And every time I start to think about these pieces, I get pessimistic. But I think that there is reason for optimism when you look at some of the things over the long term. And, you know, I'm old enough now that, you know, the short term for me is not next year, it's, you know, 5-10 years from now kind of thing. And you know, you look back and I see that there's been a lot of change in the last 25 years, but that's 25 years. And so you really have to be looking at this as a long-term endeavor rather than something that's going to have an impact tomorrow. And that's part of the problem from a policy standpoint and from a citizen standpoint, is that it gets exhausting to have to continue to push on the same things over and over again. Yeah. But generally, if you do, you win, but it takes a long time to get there.
For sure. Yeah. Chad, how about you?
I think my closing thought would be something kind of similar. Like, even though I'm only 21 years old, I feel like I've seen a pretty significant change in organizing in this country in just the last year. Yeah. With the rise of like the Black Lives Matter movement, the power of communities to be involved and to really put out policy proposals across the entire country specific for every community to really demonstrate how they needed things to change for themselves. If people are able to really come together under these different banners and realize that all these issues do connect at the end of the day to what kind of future we're actually trying to build, where resources are spent, I think we are on the cusp of something great if people are willing to really engage and let go of arbitrary differences and realize that fighting for each other as humans is the first part of the issue, because we haven't been doing that for a while. We've been fighting each other as humans instead of for each other. Yep. And I think once we really start getting past that barrier, then people are going to be able to change. And that starts at the local level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very glad that I found the local community of UConn. I feel like UConn has a very strong environmentalist activist community. And I kind of joined UConn last year as a freshman environmental studies student. I was in your class, Professor Boy. I was like, let's save the earth. Let's stop climate change. And then I didn't realize how many conversations needed to happen around it, like conversations like these. And I really appreciate what you were saying earlier about how this podcast and what we're doing is part of change. But organizing and being active parts of our communities and fighting for each other,
yeah,
seems like the right way to go.
Yeah, no, building community around this issue is really important, and keep it up. And this is great stuff, guys.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right.
So this has been the last episode of the Save the Earth podcast we'll record this semester. Thanks to everyone who listened, everyone in UConn Perg who helped create it, and of course to our two guests.